wristwatches that are televisions, virtual schools, genetically modified foods, you might say that we have finally reached Radabaugh reality.
He really did look at a problem of the day and think about how are we going to address this problem in the future.
When artist Arthur Radabaugh put his pen to paper in the 1950s and 60s, his resulting visions of the future dazzled millions of people every week. Radabaugh was an illustrator and a visual futurist whose work appeared in a syndicated Sunday comics section called Closer Than We Think. It debuted at a time when Americans were on fire with the possibilities of where technology could take us. And he was part of a generation of artists who depicted their visions of tomorrow, just like composer Art Mineo did with sound for the 1962 World's Fair.
And now, step right up to the next century in space. Sharpen up your spirit of adventure, because we've arrived at the Century 21 Exposition, crowded with the unbelievable worlds man is going to conquer, the most exciting glimpse of the future Americans have ever had. And there's more to come.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. With a modern lens, Arthur Radabaugh's drawings from Closer Than We Think might draw a smirk or a giggle, with renderings of an underwater highway between Alaska and Russia, or a car that flaps its wings like a bat. But then there are times when the whimsy gives way to something a little more shocking. Self-driving vehicles, factory farms, and solar-powered homes.
They weren't science fiction. They were realistic possibilities for a future time.
Today we're going to look at the life and eerily prophetic work of Arthur Radabaugh. We're going to explore his art with Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center. While his drawings showed us a slick and streamlined future, Radabaugh was a product of Michigan industry and rural landscapes.
He was born in Michigan. He was born in Coldwater in 1906 and later lived in Sturgis, Michigan.
Where did he go to school?
He attended Coldwater High School, and then after that, he went to the Art Institute of Chicago in 1925, but he left there before finishing the program and came back to Michigan.
So he went to high school in Michigan, did a little art training in Chicago, and then came back and got right to work. What kind of work was Radabaugh doing before World War II?
So by the 1930s or the early 30s, he's living in the Kalamazoo area, and he's working as a commercial sign painter. That's actually his job title on the 1930 census. And so he's doing large billboards and large signs. And then in 1940, he actually is living in Detroit and working for a firm creating advertising for the transportation industry. So he's working for car industry and even the tire industry and railroad. A lot of his work is in airbrush. That was sort of the medium that he was using at that time. And this is where his creativity and design starts to show. So his early work, though, is in commercial sign painting for industry.
Did the war years offer him some opportunities to do different things?
Oh, very much so. So during World War II, he starts to design vehicles and artillery for the Army.
America prepares. All America alters its pattern of life and work to meet the demand for protection. Industry is a double step to supply the sinews of safety. The armaments of war that an embattled world must have if democracy is to survive.
And I think this is where you really start to see this forward-thinking design. So he looks at existing either technology or vehicles, and he starts to add, he sort of betters them in a way. So in instances, he designs a control panel in a fighter plane that uses fluorescence instead of actual backlight, so you can't see them from the ground.
Wow.
So it's very forward thinking, but it's not, it's just to sort of solve a problem.
Mechanical genius joins with the muscle of millions of men, working to win for the ways of freedom. Freedom to think, to speak, to rise, live, and plan with one's fellow man.
So post-war, immediate post-war, he's really sort of stuck. Not stuck in a bad way, but because everything sort of takes that pause in the mid-40s after the war and people are coming home and design changes and everyone's trying to figure out, like, what's next, he actually ends up working for, it's described as a think tank in Detroit called the New Center Studio. And part of what they do is thinking about how to design for what is essentially a new Detroit. Not new Detroit in the later concept of new Detroit, but this idea of this population that we have and all this new technology that comes from the war era, plus all this surplus war material. So they start thinking about how to design for Detroit to make Detroit more efficient and better for the people living there.
For Detroit, the city of contrasts, looks toward tomorrow through the vision, cooperation, and energy of all its people.
His art career, as it had been, takes a pause, but his thinking and his design continues, actually, through the mid-40s and into the 50s.
So how did he end up doing something like a Sunday comic strip? Was that something he was given the opportunity for, or that he had to pitch?
He sort of was given the opportunity for this. So in the late 50s, especially after the launch of Sputnik, everybody starts to change their thinking.
Until 2 days ago, that sound had never been heard on this earth. Suddenly, it has become as much a part of 20th century life as the whir of your vacuum cleaner. It's a report from man's farthest frontier, the radio signal transmitted by the Soviet Sputnik.
It's fascinating the way that the United States reacts to that, and it, holistically. So even in curriculum, science curriculum, you start to see funding for high school science labs and programs for boys. But it really changes the trajectory of this country. We are no longer number one. We aren't the first. And so there's this real change. And so he actually, less than a year after the launch of Sputnik, he puts together this cartoon. And part of the reason it's a cartoon is the medium is sort of, he's used to that. But also because we are appealing to a younger group, we want teenagers to get into science. We want them to be the leaders what eventually becomes the space race. And so he has the opportunity to pitch these ideas and this idea of the future of America in terms of these inventions in science. So he doesn't have to, if he pitched it, it probably wasn't a difficult pitch at all. So it's just sort of where we were going in terms of our thinking after Sputnik.
Our next stop, one of the greatest galaxies ever exhibited. Here is man as he envisions himself in the space age.
Closer than we think was and still is just complete eye candy. People may actually recognize some of the panels from this. I feel like they've been circulated as memes and different things people share over the years. Do you have any favorite images from the stuff that he did for the strip?
Oh my gosh, there are a couple that really stand out. I like the, there's one about, it's a classroom in your home, I think it's called, or something along those lines, which really stands out right now.
Right.
because it is essentially a student sitting at a desk and they have a video monitor that has their teacher and their homework assignments appear on a screen and they answer the homework assignments and get immediate feedback. And that was in 1960. That's a 1960 cartoon. That was pretty amazing to me. I think some of the concepts are just really interesting, but the artwork itself is, as you said, you know, it's familiar. It's very familiar for that time, but it's very pretty. It has very nice colors to it. It's really cool. But I think the ones that stick out to me are the ones that we use today in our world in 2021.
He had a way of infusing his subjects with so much zip and pizzazz. There's this one where he shows us a bat-winged jet copter sort of mid-swoop as its owner's pet dog romps below in that super classic dog pose that tells you he's super, super excited that mom is returning home. And there's this other one where a mammoth spider-legged transport, you know, sort of a mass transit option, strides above this gridlocked traffic highway, and you can almost feel the lurching motion of this thing as it moves people above. Mm-hmm. He really had some true gifts as an artist.
He really did, and as a visionary, and I think the term that gets kicked around for him is imagineer. So the engineer that imagines things, and he was more of a consumer products designer. he really did look at a problem of the day and think about how are we going to address this problem in the future. So transportation's a lot of that, especially when you get cities like Detroit or New York that are so busy and traffic becomes an enormous problem, if not an impossibility.
So that would have already been an active concern in Radebaugh's lifetime.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And actually, there was a design that he had for a car parking lot where your car, you park your car on a conveyor and it lifts it up to essentially a parking spot. And that exact design is in the movie iRobot. When I saw that drawing, I was like, I've seen that.
There are some fisticuffs over who actually invented that. I know that Radebaugh put his flag down there, but suffice to say, it was a super good idea.
It was a good idea. And it does, even if it wasn't his, the time in which it came out, we see that popping up in, if obviously not in necessarily reality today, but in pop culture.
For sure.
So those do sort of recirculate as either a real item or still a futuristic possibility. He just really, I so much appreciate him looking at even food. He looked at the problem of feeding a growing population. And there's one art piece that he has about taking plants and turning them into meat substitutes. The beets to meats, I believe is what it's called.
And what a concept.
Yeah, it's very modern. And then the drive up or the drive through grocery store, the drive-in supermarket is what it's called. And today we call it curbside delivery.
Right.
So many of these concepts that were just issues of a growing population, especially within cities, what do we do and how do we fix it and what's it going to look like in the future? And that is why I think that his designs are just so fascinating to me. They weren't science fiction. They were realistic possibilities for a future time.
Stand by for surprises. The dramatic facts about coming breakthroughs in space exploration, custom-made weather, and man's triumph over disease.
We need to take a quick break. More retrofuturism from Arthur Radebaugh when we return.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Rachel, do you know anything about how Radebaugh researched his ideas? I mean, how do you get from illustrating automobiles and doing product design in that way to futurist agriculture?
I think some of it came from that New Center studio in Detroit, the post-war era, pre-cartoon era, and really sitting down with a group of problem solvers and looking at what we need to do. You also get at that time period, and you start to see it actually in the 1957 auto show.
You are about to know the thrill of seeing that which has never been seen before.
Car designs and automotive designs that reflect whether it's airplane design and then later on that quote-unquote space age design. So you get the fins on the cars and things of that nature.
A wonderful new world of Fords.
Live a wondrous new life in the Fords of a lifetime. The finest new Fords of a lifetime. In a beautiful, wonderful new world of Fords.
So I think he's sitting down early with people to figure out what do we do? How are we going to address these issues? And then that just, he continues that vein throughout his career, whether they're problems that he has to deal with on a day-to-day basis or his wife has to deal with. I think that that's just, he learns to think that way through his time with the military and thinking about problem solving there and then later on in with the New Center studio.
Have you been able to find anything out about what artists inspired him?
No, I really haven't. I think he really had sort of his own style. You see a lot of science fiction artists that come in at the same time period that have a very similar style, but I can't really determine who is inspiring whom. So I'm not entirely sure if he's just, this is him, or if he's seeing other artwork that comes through. But either way, both the science fiction artwork that is being developed and then his artwork that's being developed really informs things like Tomorrowland at Disney.
On the gala day it opened, Tomorrowland's concept and spirit were symbolized by these dedication words from Walt Disney. Tomorrowland, a vista into a world of wondrous ideas signifying man's achievements. A step into the future with predictions of constructive things to come.
And things that we sort of see today, and even the early science fiction movies that come out, the black and white ones of the late 50s and early 60s.
For centuries, science has studied Mars, the only planet where life may exist. Now the screen creates for you the fascinating, frightening spectacle of the first flight to Mars.
They're all those concepts. If you look at them all sort of under one big umbrella, you start to really see similarities.
Heavens, we're heading right into it. This could destroy us. We'll have to get out of it.
As somebody who was born in Coldwater and came of age just after World War I, it might seem odd for someone who was to be so focused on the future. Do we know, other than the fact that there was this space race period that kind of had the whole country thinking in that direction, do we know anything about his own feelings about the future, or how his, you know, what his view was of how society might develop?
There is a person who's an archivist with his collection, and she points out that a lot of his artwork, especially in the late 50s and early 60s, it actually really is a bit startling and uncertain. There's a lot of fear. You have a lot of the, you know, there's the space race and that excitement of the next launch into space after Sputnik. But you also have that possibility and that fear of the space race turning into a militarized nuclear problem. You get the, you know, the 60s see the duck and cover and a lot of fear of nuclear war. And so when you look at his art early and then even later, especially later on, though, after Sputnik, there's a lot of survival. Like, what are we going to live on the, have to live on the moon? How are we going to, are we going to mine on the moon? Are we going to live under the sea? Because there's a clear thinking that we've done something to the planet. There's something wrong. And that's why you get creating new foodstuffs and in this idea of living in a bubble or living underwater or living on the moon. So I think a lot of this idea, while he has that sort of concept of solving a problem, he sort of portrays that there's a bigger problem that we are facing with this technology. And that is this issue of just destroying ourselves, whether through nuclear war or just the nuclear capabilities that we have.
If there is one theme which dominates our tour in space, it is man's eternal search for a brighter future.
What he offers us is very much the ad industry vision of things. These beautiful colors and gorgeous drawings that are, you know, often very graceful and very fun.
20 centuries of achievement are just the prelude. We look to a new century in which science will scale the heights of creative imagination.
But that underlying suggestion that farming has to happen indoors or you might have to live in space someday, it's very sinister.
Yeah. It is. And so his idea of the future, I don't think it starts very positive. I think he sees the possibilities, but I think it gets pretty dark.
Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center. Rachel, thank you so much for spending some time with us on Arthur Radabaugh and his art.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Meet George Jetson. Do, 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 do. And that's the Stateside Podcast for today. I'm April Baer. You can find the full Stateside show at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis, and she produced this podcast episode with help from Mike Blank. In today's episode, you heard music from the 1962 World's Fair and from Blue Dot Sessions. Our theme music is by 14KT. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.